Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 3rd, 1998. In the Creekside Room this evening, we have Michael Cobbler. It's session number 98-4 and is titled Building Powerful Communities, From Problems to Issues. Let's listen in.
Referenced in the agenda, taking my cues from someone else, because there's a lot to get in. This was actually initially designed as a 5-session opportunity, and then when I arrived here, I was told that there were 4 opportunities to teach it. So, it's called downsizing. So, we have downsized, but hopefully it's not to the detriment of either the presenter or the participants. I am Michael Cobbler. I am the lead organizer. Ooh, please take copies of Toledoans United for Social Action in Toledo, Ohio. And this session is Building Powerful Communities, Turning Problems into Issues. I like to say from time to time that we have referred to Toledoans United for Social Action as Toledoans USA or TUSA. My task as lead organizer is to make sure that Toledoans USA does not become Toledoans usually sitting around. You see that there are we've had a problem getting prayer and stuff in our sessions, which is very, very important to me. So I printed something, and since it's printed, now you have to do it. Let us say together, I'll give instructions in a minute, a song for the powerless on the left-hand side of that sheet. I will be the voice, the women in our group will be the chorus, and all will participate in the all. I have called you by your name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and I will strengthen you.
You who feel you are powerless,
sure I will strengthen you.
You who are weak and so afraid,
sure I will strengthen you.
You who have nowhere to turn for help,
sure I will strengthen you.
When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and I will encourage you.
When you feel crushed by the burdens of life,
sure I will encourage you.
When you are overwhelmed with stress,
sure I will encourage you.
When your heart hurts and the wound will not heal,
sure I will encourage you.
When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and I will empower you.
Stand up for justice for yourself and for others.
Sure I will empower you.
Challenge authority, challenge the structure.
Sure I will empower you.
Say it to oppression, never again.
Sure I will empower you.
I have called you by your name. You are mine.
When you pass through the waters, you will be with us. Strengthening, encouraging, empowering us. Praise to you, Shaddai.
Thank you. Amen indeed. And I want to the jacket have any questions from previous sessions. These sessions can stand alone, but they are ideally, you know, best savored as a unit. But we're at Holden, people come and go, people have things to do, people get on this team at 10 hours. Any questions at all? We want to please give the opportunity to address that. Then let us proceed. Problems versus issues. Remember, oh beloved people, a problem is a salami. An issue is a salami sandwich. Now, you wonder, why is Cutler talking about salami? Well, there's a distinction here. An issue is not a problem, as he says. It is an outcome. More specifically, an issue is a problem which has a specific solution. Keep the salami in mind. Can you eat a salami all at once? In one go. Can you put it away? Too big. So there's an aspect of unmanageability when it comes to one person eating a salami. But if you cut it, and I use that word intentionally, and dress it up, it can be fairly useful to eat. Amen? The other thing is that in that we are always struggling with language and what it calls out of us and calls us towards, in this case, I find the classic definition of issue to be helpful. Remember way back when, well, some of you may, how sometimes we would refer to childbirth as issue. She had an issue of two children. You've heard that kind of language before? Yes, it's archaic to be sure, but all of you, especially moms, can attest to the fact that having a child is surely an outcome. Amen.
Yeah.
And it's a very specific outcome. Well, that's how organizers like to encourage leaders and organizations to use the word issue. That it is outcome, and that it is, as you will see listed here, very specific aspects related to it, very clear aspects. Issues are specific. They have an immediate benefit. They have a focus or a target. They will unify a community organization. They are controversial. They will build the organization. They are measurable. They will bring a victory for the organization. They will always take the moral high road. And an issue, in terms of organizing, is always cut out of the context of a public action. Now, I thought the usual way that we would do this kind of training is, and I have to remind myself, we've had 4 hours. So this is the fourth hour that we've had to tell about community organizing. If you were taking a training from any of the organizations that do this sort of thing, the DART training, which is the organization of which I'm part of, the initial training would take 4.5 days. And that's pretty much morning, noon, and night. They are worse than Lutherans in terms of scheduling events. The Gamaliel Foundation has a 6-day training. And the Industrial Areas Foundation has a 10-day training going pretty much morning, noon, and night. So I scratched my head even trying to present this kind of stuff in 4 hours. The first session on power, just to use one example, in the Gamaliel training, takes a day and a half. So, but If we were involved in training, we could go all the way up there, if we're involved in a training with one of those organizations, the trainer would most likely say, all right, let's list these problems. And people will mention a bunch of problems, and they say, all right, now let's cut to the issue. I want to flip that. I want to talk about the problem with problems. The problem with problems are, why can't why is a problem like a salami? And why is the issue like a salami sandwich? What is the problem with problems? I'll just give you one example. Racism. How do you solve racism?
It's too big.
It's too big. Ah. Too big. How do you solve crime? We want to solve it. We want to solve crime. You hear politicians say it all the time. We want to solve crime. And you have to say, what in the world are you talking about? What's the problem with problems? Too big is one. What's another?
Too unfocused.
Too unfocused. Mercy. That's right. Just all over the place. What's another problem with problems?
Not solution oriented.
Right. Right. Who do you go to? You don't know. And there's another aspect related to not solution oriented. What's the problem with addressing a problem? Is there anybody that you can go to usually? Is there anybody you can go to? Who do you go to when crime is a problem? Who do you go to when bad housing?
Crosses too many governmental units.
Yeah, it's too big. Another way to probably say it is too broad. But one thing is, let me just say, can you blame anybody for a problem, so to speak?
No responsible party.
Right, no responsible party. That's what's related to it. It's everybody's fault. It's nobody's fault. What's the other problem with problems? Take a look at the issues list. That'll give you some clues.
It's unspecific.
Unspecific, yes. What else? What else is problem? The problem with a problem.
They seem daunting. They're so big. It's like, where do you?
Yeah.
Where should we even try?
Yeah. Yeah. No plan.
Part of that maybe is you don't know when you won.
Can be controversial.
Right. That's right. You don't know. That's exactly. That's right. No, which is no end time. No outcome. But think about it. I mean, there's so many problems that we face, and it's assumed that whether money or people power will address it. From a particular government's point of view, and there's no plan, and there's no conversation with folk about how the problem impacts on them, and then a whole lot of money and a whole lot of time goes down the drain.
Individuals feel powerless.
Hear, hear. Yeah, I can't do anything about that. I can't fight City Hall. You've certainly hit on the most significant one. What I think I will do now is actually make an adjustment in the agenda, because I want you to hear the story that is listed as number 7, which is the Bushwick Parents Organization. They had a problem, and this is what they did. And then after that, we'll address the biblical material. This is risky, okay. I've been working all week without glasses, which are broken. But I think I can read this, though I may call on someone soon. In the summer of 1989, the staff of St. Barbara's, that's a congregation, the Roman Catholic congregation, in the Bushwick section of Brooklyn, New York, met with the local organizer of East Brooklyn Churches, that's a community organization, congregation-based, to discuss the educational reality of the parish. There were a list of knowns. The students could not read, young people could not get into good high schools in the city, dropout rates were very high. Hispanic parents often lacked skills to fight the educational bureaucracy, and Hispanic parents were looking to the church for leadership. Knowing that achieving their educational goals would involve a long struggle, the staff decided to have a series of individual meetings with parents to determine if there was enough anger and energy to take on the immense work of organizing that. Each of the 4 staff members from St. Barbara's agreed to test things out with 10 parents. They chose families with children in different schools and a variety of grade levels, and parents with varied levels of education in the United States. When they met to evaluate their work 2 weeks later, they lacked clarity. People were angry, but the anger was unfocused, and no one seemed to have any idea how to address the problem. The newest person on staff was Sister Kathy Meyer, who spoke Spanish fluently and who agreed to take on this project. She recruited 15 top leaders and sent them on a course of hundreds of individual meetings over the summer. Each leader was to verify the level of anger people felt, whether they had interest or energy to move to action, and who were potential leaders among them. July and August 1989 were incredibly hot and humid, yet the leaders persisted in speaking to parents on doorsteps, in parks, and any place people gathered to escape the heat. In September, the leaders gathered to assess the results of their work. They had conducted over 600 interviews, and remember, they were in fact one-on-ones. And it was overwhelmingly clear that parents were angry, frustrated, and confused. What was also clear that there was no consensus about what parents could do, or even about who was responsible for the educational quagmire. East Brooklyn churches taught people that problems could not be solved, but indeed had to be broken down into issues that were manageable and winnable. How to accomplish this was the question. It was decided that St. Barbara's would work in conjunction with another Hispanic parish in Bushwick to achieve an understanding of the entire district. St. Barbara's leaders then began to work with small groups of parents, having them share information and experiences. Out of a long, tedious process grew a fledgling group that became known as Bushwick Parents Organization. The first task was to do major training, which would give the parents skills to counter the jargon of the educational community, who called them apathetic, irresponsible, and unmotivated. As the parents came together to share their anger and frustration at trying to take on the educational community, They realize the injustice of the accusations from administrators in the district and in the schools. The efforts of Bushwick parents continue today, and their list of achievements is impressive. They were responsible for a series of repairs in 5 schools. They established a credible reputation as an effective force to bring city and state attention to the failure of the local school board, and they drew national attention to the ineffective and self-serving administration of bilingual education programs and the incompetence of the local superintendent. From a parish point of view, however, the internal results were equally important. This is in reference to St. Barbara's. The work in education turned out to be a powerful tool for evangelization. Sessions often began with scriptural reflections on the meaning of parenting. The work of making the schools safe and educationally sound was spoken of on Sundays as the building of the reign of God. And godly parents were recognized for their care of children in the public arena. In sermon after sermon, Father Mike Palace pointed out that Jesus had preached and healed on the streets and in the marketplace. Parents who accepted the challenge to live the gospel, declared Palace, also needed to preach in the public forums of the community and attempt to heal the sickness of a system that left children no alternative to failure. Many leaders grew out of this educational initiative. Some have moved to other states, but they have carried a new understanding of their abilities with them. Rita Ortiz is an example. She began very tentatively with Bushwick parents, unsure as to whether she could face administrators as an equal, speak in public, or act as a spokesperson with the responsibility to make decisions on the spot. Ortiz learned that with training and support, she could do these things and do them well. One night, Ortiz was asked to address in Spanish and English an assembly of 500 people. Trembling, she had to hold on to the podium, but her voice never faltered. When she went home, her daughter Carmen told her she had been standing in the back of the auditorium, and when her friends came by, she told them proudly, "That is my mother." Ortiz now lives and works in Texas, still deeply grateful for her training at St. Barbara's. Maria Perez is another parent leader who grew in understanding of her role as a responsible spokesperson. Initially, Perez resisted speaking English in public. Finally, she saw that no one else could tell her story adequately. Perez has since met with teachers, principals, superintendents, Board of Education members, and 2 chancellors. She now has a sense of pride and determination that makes her a reliable asset to the parish and to the community. This is from Signs of Hope in the City Ministries of Community Renewal, which is a book that came out earlier this year that speaks about various ministries of revitalization and hope in New York City. The thing about moving problems to issues is that it is certainly not an overnight process. It's not an automatic process. But it is a very intentional process that asks the question, how are you going to cut the salami and what are you going to use to make the sandwich? You know, is it going to be mayonnaise or wheat bread, rye, or thinking in those terms? It's important to keep in mind as you notice there's a kind of pattern here. As people recognize that they are powerless against the particular systems that they face, they start realizing that power is needed. The sources of power, organized people, organized money. They don't have organized money, so they start to organize themselves. They have conversations with one another They start to identify their self-interest in this particular area and their anger at the incompetent educational system. They determine who are the leaders as those conversations take place. People get training. That's very important. I remember in South Bronx churches, Lorraine Letton, I believe I mentioned her the other day, as the one who tapped Mayor David Dinkins on the shoulder and said, your time is up, Mayor. And she described herself as a pew warmer at St. John's Lutheran Church. She had all these gifts, but she described herself as a pew warmer. Those gifts became evident through Lorraine going to IAAF training, participating in local training, becoming a very powerful leader in her congregation and neighborhood. And then she was so focused in her leadership abilities that she couldn't warm pews anymore. And it has happened to a host of people. Then people move, I should say, people move from having those conversations and finding out where their anger is, where their passion is, and what steps they're willing to take, what training they're willing to take, and then move into identifying areas in which they can in fact win. You know, doing a power analysis, you know, who's responsible for what. You have to break that down, and all those details are very important. That takes doing some what we would call power one-on-ones. You want to find out, you know, who runs what, and where do you have to go to get satisfaction ultimately. So in all that, they were able, in Bushwick Parents and in so many other organizations, to cut an issue and to win, and actually to win a number of times over, because one win will not solve the problem. Yes, Chuck?
Yeah. Question about that power differential. I know, at least for me, when I'm talking to a powerful individual,
mm-hmm.
I often feel intimidated. I'm guessing that I'm not the only person in on God's earth who kind of has this issue. What
right.
would you suggest? I mean, it's great to, you know, nail the person who's the CEO.
Right.
But I'm fearful that I'd be quite the meek fellow with the CEO.
Well, part of what we do in training is, first of all, teach people how to act at power meetings. And it's a very important piece of training. First of all, you go as a group. That the meeting is not set up as a one-on-one. One person may speak, but you go with 5 or 10 or even 20 people. And you have a spokesperson, and then somebody else is a backup just in case you falter. And you know, you're trained and the backup is trained. And I remember a meeting with a mayor, and we knew how big the mayor's office was. So we said the mayor's office can fit 10 people. We'll need 20. and we come, and then the secretary said the mayor was only going to be 10 people. Well, we bought 20. You got a problem with that? Yeah. So. And that sets the tone. It really does set the tone. You know, mayor's thinking that, oh, I can handle this in my office. Well, sometimes they change the venue, but sometimes they crowd everybody into the office. That sets the tone right there about this organization's not kidding. And then of course, what the mayor doesn't tell you is that he or she is bringing his or her people too. And that's what happened in that case.
The mayor had about seven people there, but we outnumbered the mayor's people. You know? So mayor started out, and in organizations I've been in, we start out with prayer. We set the agenda. We start out with prayer. And that is comforting and encouraging to all of us. And then we state why we're here. We don't wait for the mayor or the CEO to state, because it's a meeting that we set. It may be on his or her turf, but we set it. So setting that in the place, then they realize, that supports us, and then they realize that we're serious. And we get trained that, and it was just so funny. I had to do a pin on the mayor of Columbus in a public action. Regular Shutka is a very big man. He is about 6'6", I'd say about 265 pounds. He played tight end for Woody Hayes in OSU days. So the organizer in training me for that event actually stood up on a table and he said, "You know you're going to be looking up at LaShutka, so I'm going to practice with you, all right?" I had to make the demand to him, and then Mayor LaShutka, we are glad to demand that you support the transportation initiative as much as you support the hockey rink." And then he's trying to take the microphone away from me. I mean, and all these things happened at the action. I mean, Shutka tried to take the microphone away. I said, "Get a microphone." He said, "He's saying to me, you better get a microphone." I said, "I'm not giving you a microphone." And they had a fight over the microphone. I mean, but we practice that stuff. I mean, that's the thing about what's important about having backups, having spokespeople, and we always have a pre-meeting just before the meeting. If we're meeting with the mayor at 10, meeting with somebody at 10, we're meeting at 9:15. And we're not only having practiced it before, but we're reviewing it on the spot with one another. And then we have an evaluation afterwards. So those are really very key tactics to what we do. And people that were once shy, oh mercy. when that passion gets going and we're clear about what's important, it is wonderful to see the transformation. And next time it's done, we practice it just as hard because sometimes relationships get in the way. Private relationships. Only 7 months before, I happened to run into the mayor on vacation in Stratford, Ontario. I mean, and we knew one another. My son went swimming with his kids and the intern I had was a dear personal friend of his, but that's the private sphere. In the public arena, he's Mayor Shutka, now I'm Pastor Cobbler, and I had to make those demands. I think that's part of the reason why the organizer chose me to do it. he said, "You need to overcome this private public thing." So, all right. but that's a significant piece of it. The training cannot be underestimated. It really is, or overestimated, actually. It cannot be overestimated. It's a very important part of taking those kinds of steps. Any other questions related to, you see the flow, the self-interest, the then doing the power analysis, cutting an issue that's manageable for the organization that you can win, so you can build on it for the next time to win. Then let's take a look at the steps on building the power organization. For Nehemiah was a bulldog, was a good friend of mine. I couldn't resist that. But if I had the opportunity in the announcements, either yesterday or this morning, I would have told you, bring your Bibles, because this is really a layout of the first few chapters of the book of Nehemiah. You know, he was the cupbearer to Artaxerxes, the king, and was significant in the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. So I won't refer to those texts, but let's just walk through what is required in building a power organization, you know, in community with a congregational or institutional base. First of all, you make inquiry of those whom you already know. That happens immediately in Nehemiah. His brother comes and tells him, oh man, the walls of Jerusalem are in horrible shape. Our people are scattered all over the place. Some of the Jews have survived, but it's pretty bad. So, what does Nehemiah do? He meets with himself. Very interesting. He meets with himself. And that becomes important all the time. You may recall, for those who hear what we said about self-interest, it's important to figure out your self-interest, first of all. Because how can you even begin to ask someone else about uncovering their self-interest if you're not clear about yours? Very, very important. And for those who weren't here, self-interest as distinguished from selflessness or selfishness, which is important to distinguish, because neither of those realities require a relationship. As we translated self inter esse, self among reality or community. But then it's so cool when Nehemiah goes to the king, that's worth reading. Speak to potential allies and funders and watch out for potential adversaries. When he goes to the king sees that he's sad, and usually, apparently, Nehemiah was very happy every time he brought wine to the king. But this time the king noticed that he was really sad. And Nehemiah maybe didn't want to say a whole lot about it, but he did say this. Then I was very much afraid. Then verse 3, I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my ancestors' grave, lies waste, and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Then the king said to me, what do you want? How about that? It's important to talk to your allies, because who knows, potential allies, because they may very well say, what do you want? A very powerful question. And when it's said, be prepared to answer it. Well, you'll go, yeah, I want a few days off. I want to, you know, go to Jerusalem and check out the scene and see if I can get my ancestors, you know, graves straight down, the walls we built. King says, you know, yeah, it's like a winner to me, you can go. But there are these other guys, they're hanging in the background, and they found out about the plan of Nehemiah to go, and they said, oh, he's gonna give us trouble. So you always gotta watch out for adversaries. I mean, it is simply saying, be aware. Then you do your own initial research, power analysis, and you meet with key leaders to share research and devise a plan. And when you start that, people are going to talk about you. Those self-interest groups, I said to someone this week about how the mayor's assistant in Columbus said to us who were part of RED, he said to somebody, he said, they're the most unchristian group I've ever met. And the rabbis in the group really appreciated that comment. and the rabbi said, great. away with you. But you always got to be listening to what people are talking about and interpreting what you're doing. Another interpretation I came across the streets was that yours truly was dismantling the what was essentially the Columbus Council of Churches by encouraging this work, that I was driving people away from the Council of Churches work. Of course, I never said anything like that. And I participated in some of the things that the Council of Churches did, namely study circles and forums on poverty and things like that. But their focus primarily was on study, and the focus of this was to build a powerful organization. Both can exist with no problem, but they saw an association of congregations as a threat and even a duplication of their work. Well, what can I say? If they wanted to do more, they could have done more. But they weren't doing more. So we did more. but folks still say Columbus, the Council of Churches. But now there's a powerful organization of 34 congregations, and they are a force in that city. And you organize for internal and external building, involve as many people as possible, and do training as necessary. Chapter 3 is a recording in Nehemiah. It's a recording of what the priests did, what the Levites did, what the other folk did, and they listed group by group and what parts of the wall they worked on. That required organization. And probably, not anybody knew how to slap on mortar, I'm sure. That required some training. But everybody participated, and some didn't participate. Even that is a lot. But it's important to know who's the leadership, who's cultivating followers, and that's another thing that I hadn't mentioned at all in all this. Our interpretation of who a leader is very simple. We don't put fancy words to, someone who has the commensurate skills to bring people to a great vision, or blah, blah, blah. A leader is a person who has followers. Matter of fact, we make claims that there are no good leaders, bad leaders, big leaders, or little leaders. And the good and bad is depending on what kind of value base they have. I know little leaders with bad values. I also know big leaders with bad values. So, but in terms of lead, is a person a leader? Do they have a following? I like to call some folk phantom leaders. At a drop of the hat, they're carrying on about, responding to something in the paper, or the mayor says something stupid, and they're in front of the microphones. And they say, this is an outrage, blah, 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 blah. Great. But I want to know, do they have followers? And Toledo was famous for this. I mean, there was a group the other day, last week, when that offensive editorial came out, editorial cartoon, and Citizens for a Just Press. Nobody even ever heard of them. But before the evening news was over, they had three people on the letterhead. I mean, it was amazing. And then they were in front of the cameras and talking about all kinds of things. And I called one of my colleagues, who are these people? Do they have any followers? And he said, no. And I said, okay, I know where that's at. You know, but you know, so quickly, you know, media wants to hear from anybody these days. So you get a couple of buddies together, and you know, and you give it a name, and you don't even have to have a letterhead anymore, and the media reports it. Whereas, you know, the people who are leaders were organized in other ways, and they also realized what the, you know, what they did, they got on paper, but you know, they'll be forgotten about tomorrow. So it's important that you involve as many people as possible. And an old minister told me a long time ago, don't use your influence before you have it. And I mean that seriously. I have been in Toledo, just as an example, as a lead organizer for 8 months now. We have not had one public action, but I won't. We have one 2 weeks from this Tuesday, and we're going to kick butt. But we haven't had one. You know, there was a labor crisis going on with school teachers. I would get phone calls. What does TUSA feel about this? We don't feel anything. We're monitoring the situation, and leaders, and then leaders are saying to me, what should we say? I'm saying, you say nothing. You ain't ready to say anything. You don't have the capacity. Now, when you have a meeting of 500 people and you challenge the mayor to submit gun safety legislation, and that you're demanding that it be done by August 4th, and you have the city council having interviewed them and checked out where they're at, and you have 7 votes or more, then you can say something. In the meantime, keep your trap shut. Don't use your influence before you have it. Now, the plan is that after July 21st, our organization will have significant influence. And after August 4th, humongous influence. And we will build on that win. But nothing is more detrimental to a congregation-based community organization than leaders mouthing off about nothing without followers behind them. I say to leaders, you produce 80 people at the July 21st meeting, you can talk all you want. You produce 3, please don't say anything to me, producer. You're not a leader. You don't have followers. Don't even try. So that's the, you know, that's how we operate, and this lead organizer means business in that life. And then finally, chapter 4, even when things are going well, do not assume they are well. This is thinking like an organizer. Know what your adversary is up to, guard against it. Think like an organizer. You read Nehemiah chapter 4, they are trying to make moves. They're trying to make more moves than a NFL running back on Sunday. But the people were prepared for it. And they relied on God. Quickly, let me move to steps toward actually doing a public action. Because this happened in Nehemiah 5. When you get back to your rooms and have a moment, don't read the first 4 chapters. Read this chapter. It is absolutely outstanding. Because it is like a public action. First of all, in doing a public action, you need to get those reports from the one-on-ones to hear what the problem is. That's what the people come to Nehemiah like nobody's business. You know, our own people were stealing from us for their charging interest on the grain that we're getting. You know, the nobles are ripping us off. And these are people, you know, these are our own folk, our own blood. Well, Nehemiah heard this, he was furious. So he said, so he met with himself again. They identified the target. They set up the public action, and then they articulated the issue. And I will read what Nehemiah said at this meeting, at this public action. And I said to them, and I called a great assembly to deal with them, and said to them, as far as we were able, we have brought back our Jewish kindred who had been sold to other nations. But now you are selling your own kin. Who must be then brought back to us? They were silent and could not find a word to say. So I said, the thing that you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God to prevent the taunts of the nations, our enemies? Moreover, I, my brothers, and my servants are lending them money and grain. Let us stop this taking of interest. Restore to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchards, and their houses. And the interest on money, grain, wine, and oil that you have been exacting from them. Now, I think Nehemiah cut a pretty good issue there. And then the target had to respond. Now, when targets say no, whether they say no or yes, we let them know that they're going to be held accountable to either their no or their yes. And it happened here, too, where the priest came up. They took an oath, and then he shook the fold out of his garment, and may God shake out everyone from house to house and from property who does not perform this promise. So that sounds like a high level of accountability, don't you think so? And then the assembly said amen and praise the Lord. Now here's the part that we leave it as hard as ever do. Celebrate the win. They actually celebrated the win. And we do that in public actions. You know, either some choir is going to sing a song or we'll warm up the chant of the organization. And in Toledo, it's we are here to stay. And do something that celebrates the win. And then you do follow up. And that was done also in Nehemiah 5. So it's important to take those steps in the formulation and execution of a public action. Now all this is wonderful stuff, and we've run out of time again. you'll see listed number 8, the characteristics of power organizations, and lifted up some of those. But number 9, I want to spend a few minutes on number 9. Now that I know all this stuff, should I start a powerful congregation-based community organization back home? Well, I can't answer that for you, but what I can say is that there are organizations that exist throughout the nation and possibly even in cities where you live that are doing this kind of work. And I should, once again, underscore cities and rural areas. There are 4 networks that are institutional-based that have various amounts of concentration across the nation. They are the DART, Direct Action and Research and Training Network, Gamaliel Foundation. Well, DART's headquartered in Miami. Gamaliel's headquartered in Chicago. PICO is headquartered in, I believe, San Francisco. And primarily concentrated on the West Coast, though it does have some East Coast organizations related to it. And then Industrial Areas Foundation, which is the oldest of the 4, and is headquartered in New York City. Also, if you're in a place where organization already exists, tell your pastor. We have found that clergy are really the key to at least getting congregations interested and involved in organizations. I can only think of one case, and it actually was a Unitarian congregation, so that's a little different anyway in terms of governance, where a congregation got involved without the support of one of their clergy staff. Because if a pastor is against it, or clergy is against it, it's probably not going to go too far in terms of the congregation's own interest in it, unless the congregation wants to do an action on their pastor. Hello. Anyway, or you guys help with that too. If you're in a place where it's not happening, talk to folk. Talk to folk. See, if you're interested in this sort of thing. Because it begins, it always begins with a one-on-one. It begins with, how can I say, the anger inside yourself. When I came to Columbus, I went to my bishop and I said, is there any congregation-based community organizations in this town? And when I was interviewing for a First English Lutheran Church, and he said to me, what? And I said, that answers my question. So I knew what I was going to do. and now it has come to pass in a mighty way. So I would encourage it. It's not fast work, it's not a quick fix, but it is work that does make a community and congregation more powerful, and also has byproducts of people getting involved in the life and work of the congregation itself, who would otherwise not be interested previously to the working community organizing. Any reflections, comments, or even evaluation? I put that quote in there. If it's worth doing, it's worth evaluating. Yes, indeed.
Related to this, I heard a speaker one time say, we don't have problems, we have solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went on to explain that every one of our problems today was a solution of a problem in the past.
Oh, yeah.
And so therefore, what you do now is something that always has to be monitored and worked with in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, indeed. And that's why it's important for organizations to have flexibility to be multi-issue oriented. You can't just take care of that and say, oh yeah, okay, now we can take our ease in Zion. Well, a cereal will come along and bite you in the butt, so you have to be always looking at what's going on and be prepared to move in that direction. Yes?
I was looking at the issues that always take the moral high ground, I thought that maybe because you're involved, this is presented from the aspect of a church-related community organizing.
Mm-hmm.
It would be different than what I was reflecting on in my experience, which was public school education, which you commented on,
mm-hmm.
and a situation where it involved people of very diverse backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was community split and became, it kind of degenerated quickly because people were passionate, all right.
Yeah.
But they were just aiming at each other. And children were involved. And, it was like, gosh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what my question is, but...
Well, part of what we do is we don't, you know, we don't pretend that we can run the schools. So we find ourselves cutting issues where we, like I say, it unifies the organization. We're not trying to take sides with the superintendent or something like that. We are saying to leadership, whether it's the board of education or whoever, you know, look, your job is to make sure it happens right, make it happen right. And we have some, and we know it's happening right when scores are going up. There's nobody's going to fight about that, really. We know it's right when 60% instead of 6% of the children in the fourth grade are above the 50th percentile. See, so we're not going after things that is going to bust up the organization. We're going things that, you know, like it is virtually impossible to do an action related to, I'll just use, you know, abortion. Yeah. You know, it ain't going to happen in this lifetime, at least not in any organizations I've been involved in. But that does not mean that Roman Catholics and Pentecostals and mainliners can't come together on some stuff, and we do. We are out of time, folks, but I want to close with the covenant song. I hope this was useful, whether you came to one session or four sessions or new or familiar or whatever. But let's close with the covenant song. I'll be the voice.
Wherever you go, I will go. I will live and love beside you. Your family will be my family, and together we will go with God.
Blessed be God, who helps us transcend the strong birth ties that bind us, who ties the cord that connects us in faith to a new security.
Wherever you stay, I will stay, content and secure around you. Your hopes will be a source of my hope, and together we will hope in God.
Blessed be God, who unites two streams to form one current together, enriching the lives of all on whom their fullness overflows.
Wherever you are, I will be, living and loving beside you. Your dreams will be my energy, and our future will be with God.
Blessed be God, who sinks deep roots in us as new creation, taking the best of what has been for the seeds of what will be.
Wherever you go, we will go. Wherever you are, there we will be. Your love is all-encompassing, and that is enough for me.
God bless you as you seek to build a more powerful community. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.